From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters. Life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present a previously recorded episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank's guest is Dr. Jay Richards, co-author of the 20th anniversary updated and revised edition of The Privileged Planet, How Our Place in the Cosmos is Designed for Discovery. Here now is Hank Hanegraaff.
Welcome to another edition of the Hank Unplugged podcast, a podcast that is absolutely committed to bringing the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people directly to your earbuds. And today I have a guest who's a hero of mine. I've known him for a long time. I've done a lot of podcasts with him. And this podcast is on, well, let me just introduce it quickly. It's the 20th anniversary edition of The Privileged Planet. We've talked about The Privileged Planet on this podcast before, but this is a very important update. And of course, Jay answers the question as to whether or not Earth is a privileged planet. You know, there are some scientists who are speculating that the Earth is merely an insignificant speck of soil that is aimlessly adrift in a meaningless universe. But evidence, and you'll hear that evidence today, refutes the principle of mediocrity. And instead, it demonstrates that our Earth, well, it's singularly privileged. And it's a planet that is designed for discovery. And Jay gives a lot of reasons for that. And I'll formally introduce him in just a moment. I'll even mention his last name. But the first of those reasons is that there are unique conditions that are necessary to support intelligent life, and they turn out to provide the best overall conditions for scientific discovery. A second reason, and I put this in a memorable format in one of my books, but the second reason is that we live in the best overall age of the universe. Think about that, the best overall age of the universe to do cosmology. In our time, the cosmic background radiation that is left over from the Big Bang is readily observable. But here's the key. It won't always be like that. And that radiation confirms that the universe is not eternal, but it began in the finite past. And let me give you one more reason. I like to do things in threes. From habitability to discoverability, and these are two key words in this book. From habitability to discoverability, Earth's status in the universe is surely, absolutely, beyond a doubt, one of privilege. And if you were to reduce that to an accident of cosmic evolution, you would be short-sighted. But if you recognize it as privileged, well, that's sublime. And that's precisely why this book is titled The Privileged Planet. And it is one of my favorite books. And this is the 20th anniversary edition. And it has many additions to it that are important. So this is a book that you can get on the web at equip.org. You can write me at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. It's for those who stand shoulder to shoulder with us in the battle for life and truth. Well, let me give you Jay's last name. If you followed the podcast, you already know what his last name is. It's Richards, J. W. Richards. And he is director of the DeVos Center for Life, Religion, and Family at the Heritage Foundation. He's a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, and he's the executive editor of The Stream. Now, Jay is incredibly credentialed. If I went over all of his credentials, it would take a while. But he is a PhD in philosophy and theology from Princeton Theological Seminary, among other things. I'm not going to go through the other things. He's contributed to many articles in the Christian Research Journal, and he's the author of 14 incredible books. Maybe it's more by now. Maybe it's 15. I don't know. 14 or 15 incredible books, including the New York Times bestsellers, Infiltrated and Indivisible, and a book titled Money, Greed, and God, which was one of my favorites. It also won a 2010 Templeton Enterprise Award. He wrote a book that I followed religiously for a long period of time, but I don't anymore. I need to get back to. When I'm looking at Jay, I'm thinking I need to get back to this book. It's titled Eat, Fast, and Feast. And then a book that is incredibly relevant to this age. It's titled The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines. I mean, that's an incredible book, and I want to ask Jay a question about that in just a moment. But the book that we're talking about today is The Privileged Planet, and we're going to focus on that remarkable work. It's just come out not long ago in the updated, revised format. And so, Jay, as always, I love having you on the podcast, and you are one of my heroes. You're someone that not only does incredible writing and speaking, but you do the research that's necessary to be able to demonstrate that what you're talking about is not your own vivid predilections, but it is faith founded on a refutable fact. So thanks for being on the podcast again.
Oh, thank you, Hank. It's so great to be with you. So fun. I mean, we probably talked about the book 20 years ago, which is kind of scary to think, but you know, Guillermo Gonzalez and I, when we were writing it, we actually realized, okay, the book's coming out in 2004. There's going to be a total solar eclipse in the US in 2024. So maybe we'll do a 20th year anniversary edition and we'll update it. But of course, that's something you tell yourself. And then that's actually what happened. And one of the most important things that I learned in the process was that you're a lot better writer 20 years older. It's because when you read it, it's like, gosh, I've spent 20 years writing and trying to translate stuff for broader and broader audiences. And so what we thought would just be an update and some references ended up really being a rewrite, not to change the argument, but just to hopefully make it more accessible.
Before we get into The Privileged Planet, I did want to ask you a quick question on The Human Advantage. We're going to be in Athens in a month's time. And in this book, you talk about the future of American work in an age of smart machines. A lot of people think that it is possible for machines to replace human beings. You make the argument in that book that that will never happen. Why?
Because we're not machines. That's the simple answer. And so for something to entirely replace us, they would have to be everything that we are. Now, you might say, well, okay, but the things we do that are machine-like, that has everything to do with our work. And so therefore, the meaningful work that we do will ultimately be replaced by machines. And so part of this is a metaphysical claim, right? But part of it is a kind of empirical claim. And so when I wrote the book, it came out in 2018, I wanted to give the other side as much credit as possible. And so in other words, I basically said, okay, let's assume that anything that can be automated using a combination of AI and robotics will be automated. Moreover, let's assume that that's going to happen in our lifetimes. What does that mean? And the book's really, though there's a lot of philosophy in it, it's really designed to say, okay, if that happens, here's what you need to do to prepare. And my argument is that, in fact, machines will do a lot of stuff that humans are doing right now, but there's a lot of other stuff that they won't do. And as long as we pivot to the things that are uniquely human, we will be able to do profound things, important things that are meaningful, that are work. It's just that it will look different than what it looks like now, just as the way we farm now looks different than the way it looked 100 or 200 or 500 years ago, or the way we write. If technology permanently replaced people, that is, it permanently created massive unemployment, all of human history would be this really depressing story of more and more people finding that they don't have anything to do. But that's not what happens at all. At different technological stages, what that does is maybe something that we need a lot of labor for at an earlier period, we're able to automate or develop machines so that, you know, it only takes five people to do what it took 5,000 people to do at a previous era. That doesn't mean there's nothing left to do. It means that, you know, we're creatures made in the image of the creative God. We find new and important and hopefully dignifying things to do that presuppose all the technology that sort of went before us. And so there's a bit of metaphysics in this. What are humans? Can we be reduced to machines? There's a good bit of economics. And then there's also some predictions about what I thought was and was not going to happen. And I thought, for instance, that automated long-haul trucks, that would be easier to pull off than, say, a housekeeper that's entirely robotic, because that involves complex movement through space. I'd say the biggest surprise is probably how powerful these chatbots, so-called large language models, are, how good they are. But it doesn't prove that we're machines. It doesn't mean these things are going to become conscious. It just means that we're able to develop systems that can call and sort and run probabilities on all the intelligent choices that we make. And so everything you see in Claude or in ChatGPT is it the self? It's itself the result of human intelligence, and the data it's trained on is all information that's the result of human intelligence.
Stay right there. We'll be back soon to rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Dr. Jay Richards. In the 20th anniversary revised and updated edition of The Privileged Planet, How Our Place in the Cosmos is Designed for Discovery, astronomer Guillermo Gonzalez and philosopher Jay Richards lay out remarkable evidence showing that our Earth is a privileged planet designed for discovery. To receive the 20th anniversary revised and updated edition of The Privileged Planet, How Our Place in the Cosmos is Designed for Discovery, for your gift to the ongoing work of the Christian Research Institute, call 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI. Or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. Has God spoken? Are the words of Scripture merely human in origin, or are they in fact the very words of God Himself? 3 years in the making and based on two decades of research and reflection, Hank Hanegraaff's monumental book, Has God Spoken?, answers what is surely the most important question facing our world. In Has God Spoken? Memorable Proofs of the Bible's Divine Inspiration, Hank counters the contentions of the Bible attackers and clearly shows that belief in the Holy Scriptures is not a guess or wishful thinking. It is the only logical conclusion after an honest examination of overwhelming evidence. Order Has God Spoken? From the Christian Research Institute by calling 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. Equip.org. The Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition is the comprehensive collection of the most often asked questions Hank Hanegraaff has received throughout his four decades as host of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. With more than 500,000 copies already in print, this newly revised and expanded Collector's Edition helps seekers and skeptics alike sort through the truth on topics such as reliability of the Bible, religions and cults, the resurrection and afterlife, and many more issues vital to a better understanding of God in Christ and our relationship to Him. To receive your copy of the Complete Bible Answer Book, Collector's Edition, Revised and Expanded, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI. Or visit us at equip.org. The number of wolves surrounding the Christian flock is growing, and they relish nothing more than docile sheep utterly incapable of defending themselves. From militant secularists at home to militant Islamists abroad, the assaults on biblical Christianity are growing dangerously. But Christian Research Institute support team members aren't in favor of feeding these wolves. Instead, each day they're making possible an array of outreaches that defang these wolf packs with solid arguments and evidence that have stood the test of time. What's more, support team members are equipping themselves with CRI's Equipping Essentials, a hand-picked collection of the best apologetics tools around. Your selection of resources are just our way of saying thanks. To learn more about the benefits of membership, simply visit equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. Here again are Hank Hanegraaff and his guest philosopher Jay Richards as they continue their conversation.
So everything you see in Claude or in ChatGPT, is it the self? It's itself the result of human intelligence, and the data it's trained on is all information that's the result of human intelligence. And so I just think that's the kind of fundamental reality. And the nice thing is there's this metaphysical claim that transhumanists make that machines will surpass us. The best we can do is upload ourselves to the machines. They give specific dates. And so I said, okay, great. Let's make some empirical claims and see who's right and who's wrong about this stuff.
Yeah. So what about the panpsychism, the idea that somehow or other there's a materialistic way in which you can explain consciousness?
Yeah, it seems so strange to me because, of course, as you said, panpsychism, in some ways, that would be the philosophically consistent way that transhumanists could sort of do this, that every bit of matter, you know, sort of has a little consciousness in it. And when you combine it into larger and larger structures, like a human, right, we're made up of all sorts of different cells, there's kind of this emergent consciousness for matter. That's an interesting argument. I don't think it really works because we recognize that there's just the constituents of matter are not themselves agents in the ways that humans or even, say, animals are. But what's interesting is that almost all the transhumanists don't go that route. They're not panpsychists. They're not pantheists. They're materialists. And so you get someone like Ray Kurzweil, who in a sense really believes that we're machines. And so he thinks, look, you get computers working fast enough and sophisticated enough, they really can become everything we are. And then you say, okay, well, so what are you talking about? What about our consciousness? What about our agency? What about the fact that we're persons? And he will either say, well, that's something that can be uploaded, by which he ends up meaning a brain pattern. Or he says, well, who's to say that we're conscious? Maybe we're just, that's an illusion or something, which to me is, okay, you're making an argument that our consciousness and agency is an illusion. That's a pretty good argument that whatever you're thinking is seriously wrong, right? If that's your conclusion, I doubt your premise. But that's the kind of dilemma. If you're a committed materialist, you're sort of stuck because it's not like you can say, well, I believe that humans are a unique hybrid of body and soul, and the soul can somehow be detached from the body and uploaded. They never appeal to that. So they're never going to deal to a Christian anthropology. They never really even appeal to panpsychism. They're just materialists and they're inconsistent. And I think the reason they're inconsistent is because all of us, no matter what our kind of metaphysical views, if in fact human beings are this unique, we're unique creatures that are the dust of the earth and the breath of God, we are fully human and are fully material, fully spiritual at the same time. If your anthropology doesn't get that right, then you're going to go off the rails somewhere, but you're never ultimately going to be able to deny it. So even the materialist who really doesn't have a basis for believing he has freedom or agency or consciousness nevertheless presupposes it when he's not thinking about it. And so he ends up being inconsistent. And so materialists almost always end up kind of metaphysically schizophrenic, which is what I think you have. You certainly have this in transhumanism. You have it in gender ideology, where the person is treated as a kind of disembodied gender soul that might get stuck in the wrong body. All these attempts to kind of account for humanity, but without getting the Christian and the biblical understanding of the richness of what the human person is. If you don't get that, you still have to be confronted by it because you are yourself a human person in all of its fullness. But your metaphysic doesn't really and can't really account for it.
Yeah, I want to get right to the privileged planet. You know, we did do the first broadcast on this back in 2004, as you mentioned. I had hair back then. You still have hair 20 years later. But what is the privileged planet hypothesis?
Mm-hmm. You summarized it. It's basically, here's the claim, is that those rare places in the universe where life can exist, that is the most habitable places in the universe, are also the best places overall for doing science, for scientific discovery. So observers, complex observers like ourselves, find themselves in the best places overall for observing. And so this is, you know, multiple parts of this argument are required. The first is this whole idea of habitability, that not just any old place is going to be good for life. Almost everything we learn and everything, frankly, we've learned since in the last 20 years I think shows that you got to get a lot of stuff at the local level, that is the kind of level of the planetary system, just right in order to have a planet that can even host life. We're not even talking about life itself. We're just talking about a planet in which life can exist and persist. And so that's interesting on its own. But you could ask this other question. Okay, if you needed to do science, you needed to discover whether the universe had a beginning. That's got to be the biggest question. How old the universe is, how it works, what the stars are, what the world is made of, what fundamental principles govern the movements of matter. All these kinds of questions you need to ask, if you're going to do science. And then you say, okay, and you could pick only one place to be. Where would that be? And you run the analysis, and what you discover is the best place to be is the one place where life can exist. That's an astonishing discovery. It's one thing to say that habitable planets are very rare in the universe. It's another thing to say that there's this pervasive pattern in which the things you need to build a habitable planet also set that planet up for doing science. And science in that place can be done a lot better than the less habitable places. And it's that coincidence, that combination of the needs for life and the needs for scientific discovery together, that we think that forms a strong design argument. It's like, okay, look, if the universe is designed for discovery, that's exactly what you would expect. If you're a materialist that thinks everything is the result of blind chance and necessity, this is just, there's really no explanation for it. It's just a weird brute fact that you can't account for. So yeah, maybe this isn't a deductive proof for God's existence, but it's a pretty darn strong argument for design of the universe by an intelligence that transcends it.
So explain what your argument is not, because a lot of critics say that you're making the claim that Earth is unique and therefore it is designed. That's not really your argument, is it?
Not at all. And in fact, whether Earth or Earth-like planets are common or rare in the universe, is metaphysically ambiguous. I mean, put it this way: if there's a transcendent God, as we believe, God could create the universe in a lot of ways. He could have made it just our solar system with life on Earth. He could have made it where there's habitable planets everywhere. All those things are sort of possible for God. And so it's not like theism entails either that life be rare or life be common. And so just because you discover that, okay, we've got a really big universe, maybe 10 to the 22 observable stars in the universe, the observable universe, that's a big place, a lot of potential planets around those stars. It could be, for instance, if you're a materialist, you might say, okay, well, maybe it's just really, really hard to get the conditions for life, but in a universe that's large enough, one will happen to have the conditions that life needs. Like it's like a vast cosmic lottery. And in that one place, life will, presumably evolve or appear. And that's kind of the materialist assumption. And so a materialist could be fine with life being rare in the universe, even though most materialists, for some reason, go the other way. They think, well, whatever happened here must have happened countless times elsewhere because there's nothing special about the Earth. That's the general kind of drift in the debate. Nevertheless, Guillermo Gonzalez and I say, look, really kind of metaphysically, it could go either way. And so we want to know empirically whether that's true or not. And so we just think that would be a bad argument to say, okay, well, gosh, it's Earth-like planets or habitable planets are really rare in the universe, therefore God had to do it, because that's just not a great argument. I mean, there's no way else to put it. But that is what people very often thought the argument was going to be, because it takes a bit of time to explain that, no, we're building an argument on this remarkable coincidence of the needs for life and the needs for scientific discovery. We needed the rarity in order to see the pattern, that in fact, compared to most of the other places and the other planets where that we actually know exist, there's just a few that actually make only one that we know of so far that can possibly host life. And so it's very interesting to discover that those very rare places are also the best places for doing science.
Yeah, so your argument is about the fact that Earth is habitable and it's also a perfect place for scientific discovery.
That's right. Yeah. Or perfect in the sense that it's the best
Ideal.
optimized sort of condition. Yeah. If you think of these things, there's lots of trade-offs, of course, that have to be made. So the best overall place, like if you, in other words, if you can only pick one place and you need to know things, say, about the recent past, you need to know things about the distant past, you need to know some stuff about physics, whether the universe had a beginning, all these kinds of things. Turns out there's complicated trade-offs because there's kind of competing conditions. So for instance, if all you wanted to do is discover the background radiation, okay, well, the best place to detect that would be between galaxies, probably in intergalactic space. But you would optimize your situation to discover that one thing. That would be a terrible place to discover the laws of gravity or what happened in the recent past, or to do chemistry. And so what you want is to optimize for all these kinds of competing conditions. And when you get that, then that's the argument that in fact what you get is an Earth-like planet. You get the planet that we have.
We'll have to stop here for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with philosopher Jay Richards. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you the 20th anniversary revised and updated edition of The Privileged Planet, How Our Place in the Cosmos is Designed for Discovery. Just call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website at equip.org. That's equip.org. Or you can write to CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters. Life matters more. Has God spoken? Are the words of Scripture merely human in origin, or are they in fact the very words of God Himself? 3 years in the making and based on two decades of research and reflection, Hank Hanegraaff's monumental book, Has God Spoken?, answers what is surely the most important question facing our world. In Has God Spoken? Memorable Proofs of the Bible's Divine Inspiration, Hank counters the contentions of the Bible attackers and clearly shows that belief in the Holy Scriptures is not a guess or wishful thinking. It is the only logical conclusion after an honest examination of overwhelming evidence. Order Has God Spoken? From the Christian Research Institute by calling 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. Equip.org.